Hello, this is Mike Burek, your host and producer of Konnichiwa, The Well, a podcast series about topics of interest to the global Ukrainian community. Today is Tuesday, February 20th, 2024. This episode is produced for The Ukrainian Weekly, a newspaper published in English for the global Ukrainian community since 1933. Our guest today is Anders Östlund, who is a Swedish economist, former senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and a preeminent specialist on East European economies. Welcome, Anders. How are you?
Thank you. Very well indeed. Nice to talk to you, Michael.
Thank you so much for joining us today. To start off with, for our audience who might not know you that well, can you talk a little bit about your professional career?
Yeah, basically, I'm an economist. I did my PhD at Oxford, and I wrote about private enterprise in Poland and East Germany, and completed my dissertation in 1982, since I presumed that communism was to end rather soon. I wanted to see what comes afterwards. And then I followed particular Poland and the Soviet Union all along. And I was happy that 1984 to 87, I was posted as a Swedish diplomat reporting on economic affairs in Moscow. And during that period, I traveled often to Ukraine. And I followed the Ukrainian economy, actually, since 1985. And I've done so in various capacities as a professor at the Stockholm School of Economics from 1989 to 94. Then I worked as an economic advisor to President Kuchma from 94 to 97. I worked at five different think tanks in Washington for the last 30 years. And I've always dealt with the Russian economy and the Ukrainian economy. And in recent years, primarily with the Ukraine. I've been co-chairing two presidential commissions on economic reform in Ukraine. And I've been on a couple of boards, notably of Ukrainian state railroads. And I follow Ukraine very closely. And I know most of the people. I've written two books about the Ukrainian economy and edited two books. So this is my great passion.
Anders, in your February 14th, 2024 article in the Kyiv Post, you wrote, "Europe needs to face up to today's reality. Either Ukraine, and implicitly the West, wins, or Russia wins the current war. The obvious conclusion is that Russia must be defeated. What should the EU be doing now for Ukraine to secure a victory?"
True in everything that they have in terms of arms to Ukraine and provide the financing. The Baltic states have come up with a wonderful idea that a quarter of a percent of GDP should each year be devoted to Ukraine of all EU countries, and they are doing it themselves. The Nordic countries are also doing so. And Denmark, for example, the other day decided, okay, we give all our artillery, which is quite sophisticated, to Ukraine. Ukraine is the first defense line of Europe. Ukraine today has 1 million men and women under arms, probably more than all the EU countries together. So it's the Ukrainians who best can use the arms. And then we also have the financing. I don't think that the US Congress will decide positively on the $60 billion for Ukraine. Then the EU has to step up as an organization or as individual countries. And what I see is that we are doing both. Europe, with the sole exception of Hungary, is extremely committed to the victory of Ukraine.
And speaking of the U.S. Congress, why do you think Republicans do not support additional aid for Ukraine?
I think it's a sheer corruption. Too many Republicans are receiving anonymous funding from Russian businessmen. We just learned that in 2018, the current speaker, Mike Johnson, who doesn't support Ukraine, got $37,000 from a company called American Ethane, but owned 28% by three big Russian businessmen. And one of them is a billionaire close to Putin. The big US problem is that it allows millions of anonymous companies. And these many anonymous companies are, to a substantial extent, financing both parties. We don't know who is paying our US politicians. And this is normally called corruption, only that in the US, it's unfortunately legalized.
Do you think the death of the Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny will change the attitude of U.S. Republicans regarding aid for Ukraine?
No, I don't think that they could care about it at all. And we can also see, I was looking through what they had said, and I mean, the truly odious pro-Putin Republicans, most of them haven't mentioned Navalny. And if they have, for example, Trump himself, in a pretty neutral fashion, Navalny died more or less. Matt Gaetz made a similar statement. They don't condemn Putin for quite obviously having committed this murder. So I don't think that that will change anything with the Republican and the Ukrainians. They are voting for the money. And of course, we don't know exactly how they get the money, but we have all reason to assume.
Ukraine needs security guarantees for its long-term survival. Do you think NATO will invite Ukraine to become a member before the war ends?
It's clear that the current U.S. administration, in particular Jake Sullivan and Bill Burns, the CIA head, are against it. And the wishy-washy German Chancellor Olaf Scholz is against it because he doesn't seem to like decisions. And these are the two most important countries in NATO. I think that something has to change in Washington. And that might be a positive impact on the Biden administration, on the current fight in the Congress, that all of a sudden the Biden administration realizes that their far too cautious policy towards Russia has been harmful to themselves and to President Biden's re-election chances. So now we hear that the U.S. is discussing delivering long-distance missiles to cruise missiles to Ukraine, the so-called ATACMS, and that should have been done long ago. So I think that some people who have wanted to play down the war in Ukraine might, on the Democratic side, might now realize that this was a mistake and that they had better play it up and make sure that Ukraine wins.
Anders, what do you think is the best way to finance Ukraine to rebuild the country after the Russian invasion?
Thank you, Michael, for such a leading question. Of course, to take the $300 billion of Russian sovereign assets that have been so-called immobilized, that is frozen in the West. And there's no reason not to do so. we have had a long debate, which has clarified that they should be seized and delivered to Ukraine as war reparations. And a few things have happened. Chrystia Freeland in Canada has been the leader on this all along. David Cameron, now Lord Cameron, as Minister for Foreign Affairs, has taken up this as a leading question in Britain. And this seems to have tilted the US administration in that direction as well. And Japan, for reasons I don't know, seem to support it. The main impediments are Germany, the permanently decision-unable Chancellor Olaf Scholz has gone against it so far, and he leans on Christine Lagarde, the president of the European Central Bank, who thinks that this would undermine the euro, which a lot of economists have clarified is not the case. Most prominently, Larry Summers, the former US Treasury Secretary. So we have a lot of know-nothings who are arguing this can't be right, when the people who actually think say, sorry, this is right. And I think that this is seeping through, but it's a tragedy that it has taken 2 years even to come close to a decision. This should have been decided early on, make the money available as war reparations for Ukraine.
Do you think foreign investment in Ukraine will grow once the war is over?
Sure, but we don't know when the war will be over, and few people invest much during the war. What we do see is that the five big US arms producers are very interested in going in, and so are also a couple of European arms producers, in particular Rheinmetall in Germany and Saab in Sweden, want to establish factories as fast as possible. And we are seeing a wonderful activity. I met recently with the Minister of Strategic Industries, that is war companies, Alexander Kamishin, and he said that there are now 400 private companies and 100 state companies that are producing arms in Ukraine. In last year, they doubled their production to $2 billion. This year, they will double again to $4 billion. And he assesses that they will produce this year 1 million drones. And these are currently the most both cost-effective and militarily effective arms that Ukraine can use. And Ukraine is using them very effectively on Russian oil facilities, oil ports and refineries. So I think that this is a very important part of the current economic and military warfare that Ukraine defends itself with.
Anders, unfortunately, we're just about out of time, but I do have one more question for you. What should the Ukrainian government do in the long term to encourage the growth of small and medium-sized businesses?
Small and medium-sized businesses need the rule of law. And fortunately, the European Union, in its accession conditions, have stated four key rule of law conditions, in particular, cleaning out the thoroughly corrupt constitutional court and the Supreme Council of Justice. And this is what is vital to small business. The Minister of Finance, the Central Bank, and the tax authorities are behaving very well, surprisingly well, in the midst of the war. The problem is the top of the legal apparatus, and now the EU is likely to make sure that it's cleaned out.
Anders, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on Kudenitsia.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I have been speaking with Anders Åslund, a Swedish economist, former senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and preeminent specialist on East European economies. This episode of Krenitsia has been produced for The Ukrainian Weekly, a newspaper published in English for the global Ukrainian community since 1933. And I'm Mike Burek, your host and producer of Krenitsia. Until next time, that's all for now.